From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, why communities around the U.S. are consolidating services like schools and why that worries some people.
When you lose a school like this, it's the exact same feeling you have when your home burns down with all of your family photographs. It's the exact same feeling because I've experienced both.
A new festival on Milwaukee's lineup will meet the driving forces behind Saturday's India Fest. And Milwaukee chef and author Alamelu Vivaran gets requests for specialized Indian recipes.
They said, Alamelu, the vegetable, rice dish, and the lean proteins will lend itself to gluten-free diet. So I decided that's what I want to do. I want to help all these people.
And a radio trip to the moons of Pluto. Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Across the country, cities and counties are running out of places to turn for cash. Residents complain that taxes are too high, but then wince at cuts to services. But here in southeast Wisconsin and elsewhere, leaders are turning to a third option, consolidation of services or of whole communities. While it can save millions, some critics say autonomy is more important. Lake Effect's Amy Kiley reports.
At Waukesha County Communications, 911 dispatchers assure callers help is on the way.
911, what's the address of your emergency? Okay, what city is that in, ma'am?
The answer could be one of 29 communities within Waukesha County. That's because this is a consolidated dispatch center. Local governments pool emergency calls here to try to improve quality and save money. The most recent city to join predicts it will save it nearly $1 million a year. Such consolidation is on the rise. Even before the recent recession, Census Bureau data showed intergovernmental spending rose 234% from 1992 to 2007. Now all states have service-sharing laws, including Hawaii, where counties are on separate islands. Still, for some opponents, studies are irrelevant when autonomy is on the line. In Waukesha County, the city of Waukesha is not part of the dispatch center. Dennis Angle is deputy chief of the police department.
The patch that sits on my shoulder says, Waukesha, my job is to serve the citizens of the city of Waukesha. That's their expectation of me, to render the best service that we possibly can to them.
Angle says his city does share some services, but he's concerned joining the dispatch center might reduce emergency response quality. Such concerns are common in consolidations, though some wonder if it's more about the fear of losing jobs. And some opponents are concerned about something even more nebulous, civic identity. A bitter fight in Nebraska 8 years ago led to the closure of more than 200 small school districts. To try to save his daughter's school, farmer Mike Nolis formed Class Ones United.
When you lose a school like this, it's the exact same feeling you have when your home burns down with all of your family photographs. It's the exact same feeling because I've experienced both.
Russ Inbody says he sympathizes with people like Nolis. He's head of finance and organization for the Nebraska Department of Education.
It's an emotional issue, and sometimes you just have to bite the bullet for the welfare of the students.
Inbody helps guide schools through mergers. He says they give students better resources and spread out the tax burden. As rural communities shrink, he says, consolidation is necessary. More extreme is the complete merger of two municipalities. Princeton, New Jersey used to be a so-called donut town with the borough in the middle and the township around it. They shared services, but residents voted down consolidation 3 times. In 2011, it passed easily. The Center for Governmental Research helped with that process. Its economist, Kent Gardner, says Princeton officials had to address the very real fear of change.
People like to think that the policeman actually will recognize them. You know, it's going to be Sergeant Joe, and Sergeant Joe is going to know me. If we consolidate, then maybe it'll be somebody I've never seen before.
David Goldfarb is the only Princeton politician who spoke against the merger. He says he and others on the borough council worked hard to preserve its charm. He worries the new government, which took over this year, won't care for the downtown in the same way.
When I walk out of my house and see people out on the street, it gives me a warm feeling. It's a place that's vital and appealing both to residents and to visitors. it didn't happen by accident.
Time will tell who's right about Princeton and consolidation issues here in Wisconsin. While consolidation supporters cite significant upsides to these mergers, there's something studies can't easily predict: how people will feel about changes to their communities. For Lake Effect, I'm Amy Kiley.
Consolidation is something that has been studied closely in many places. Here in this area, the Public Policy Forum issued a report last year on the possibilities for service sharing among fire departments in the southern half of the county. We spoke with Forum President Rob Henkin at the time, and he explained why emergency services are often a good match for consolidation efforts.
When you are really looking at significant financial savings, public safety is such a huge part of municipal budgets that you really have to start with police and fire. Now, again, that doesn't mean that those are the services that in the end we're going to decide are worth sharing to a greater extent and or consolidating, because there are lots of reasons why public safety is a big area of expenditure and it's a big priority for local decision makers. But that being said, what led us to really want to look at fire services here was the fact that if indeed one of the drivers is budget savings, then that's an area that you have to look at. Also, there's a very successful model within our midst. The North Shore Fire Department is a successful model of a consolidated fire department that not only has saved money for the North Shore communities, but has actually enhanced the level of service.
So looking at Southern Milwaukee County, there obviously is a geographic advantage here.
Yes. And we actually looked at all 8 municipalities in the southern part of the county, decided that there were 5, Greenfield, Hales Corners, Greendale, Franklin, and Oak Creek, that really asked us to come in and take a look. Those are communities. 2 of the 5 are among the fastest growing in the entire state of Wisconsin. There's a lot of cooperation in terms of mutual aid already going on between the 5 departments. So this was a matter of those 5 municipalities saying, look, we're not sure we want to do this, but we at the very least want to look at some enhanced sharing of services and perhaps look at a fully consolidated model similar to the North Shore.
So as you looked into the various consolidation possibilities, obviously you had to look at the inner workings of fire departments. What are the areas within fire services that cost the most?
Well, costing the most personnel is roughly 90% of a fire department budget, at least for these 5 communities, is personnel. And that's both salaries and fringe benefits and overtime. And so we took a look at all of those areas. But there are also other areas of operations that have costs associated with them, the apparatus. So that includes the fire vehicles. It includes the equipment that's on the fire vehicles. It includes the ambulances. Those are big costs for fire departments. And so we've seen opportunities in terms of exploring service sharing and full consolidation for reducing costs in both of those areas.
Well, and so what are the specific areas? How would combining these services, because obviously the idea is to provide the same level of service. What are the areas where you would envision and this report would envision cost savings could be accomplished?
Well, what we did was, first of all, try to catalog where is there already some service sharing going on. And there are several areas. Training is one where there's some limited degree of service sharing. Could there perhaps be more was the question. In terms of mutual aid and backup and so on, there is some sharing going on. But then we decided to model 3 different approaches. One would be what we labeled an enhanced service sharing model. A second would be what we termed an operational consolidation model. And then the third would be full consolidation. So to directly answer your question, the first model really speaks to that, because in 3 key areas of fire department operations that really don't have a noticeable impact to the average taxpayer or citizen, for example, are training, fire inspections, and vehicle repair and maintenance. And we found that in those 3 areas, irrespective of any other move to possibly merge operations or consolidate in any way, if these 5 communities were to look at perhaps doing those 3 aspects of fire services jointly, there could certainly be some opportunity for operational efficiency.
Rob Henkin, president of the Milwaukee-based Public Policy Forum, speaking to us last year about a study of potential mergers of emergency services in southern Milwaukee County. The first large-scale local ethnic festival celebrating Indian culture is scheduled for this Saturday. We'll get a preview of India Fest Milwaukee when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. For many, it would not be summer in Milwaukee without our lineup of ethnic festivals. Yet even as the city celebrates its German, Irish, Polish, Mexican, and other heritages, there have still been holes in the lineup. Like, say, the culture of the second most populous nation in the world. Aside from some small community celebrations, there has never been a large-scale celebration of India here. Well, the time has come in a more modest way for Milwaukee's latest outdoor festival. India Fest Milwaukee is a one-day free celebration in Bayview's Humboldt Park this Saturday. It promises Indian music, fashion, food, and even a cricket match. Dan Harmon is joined by three of the festival's organizers, all from the organizing group Spindle India. They include Pramina Nath, Rina Modak, and her husband, Shubhendu Modak.
The Indian Independence Day is the 15th of August, and we wanted to do it closer to 15th August. So we had another date, is the 17th August. But due to all the park and all the availability, so we got the 24th August is the best possible day, which is closer to the 15th August, and whatever we exactly want, we can fulfill on that day. So that's what it is, 24th of August.
To follow up with Shubhendu's, the reason we actually picked up this day is because of the fact that India Fest hasn't been ever been done, and at the same time, Independence Day was never been celebrated in a fashion and a scale that we are going at this point. So we picked a date very close to that, and also wanted to attract as many as people as possible, knowing that majority of the Indians actually go to India during this vacation. So that's why the statistic date is.
What is it that people can expect to find at this festival, this first outdoor Indian festival, I believe is how it's been described? What are people going to find? Are they going to find information about Independence Day, food, music, all the above?
All the above. It's basically a collaboration tool and platform that's how we're going to utilize it. As you know, India is so diverse. It's the most diverse country in the world. At the same time, we are united as a Indian. We have so many different types of foods and music and languages and stuff like that. We wanted to bring all of them together in one cohesive platform that where we could see diversity. At the same time, we can have fun and learn from each other. At the same time, we want to bring those diversity to the Milwaukee area for our folks to know as well.
As Purnima mentioned, we are going to show everything, all culture, and we are very colorful. Our India's dress and food and different taste of food and all stuff we are trying to bring all together so that people can enjoy, different part of India, people can enjoy all together in one day and within few hours.
Okay. It doesn't sound easy. I mean, just knowing what I know about India, that you said you want to represent the country in one day, which to me, that's a really tall order.
It is. At the same time, we're doing it for the first time, and we definitely have the vision and the tenacity to take it to the next level. We're foreseeing that next year it's going to scale up to at least 2 days, if not 3 days. We do have enough material to show to the world and bring a lot more in-depth information to the Milwaukee area. So I think we do have the vision to scale up pretty quickly.
Another factor is that the way we design the whole program and the concept so that Indian can enjoy their culture, whoever from the which part of the or which state they are. Same way, those who does not know about the India, they can learn about the India. They can know where is the India, what type of culture, what type of food, how they wear the dresses. So all this. So we both the aspect we put into mind while designing the whole program for Indian and non-Indians. So all of them can enjoy.
It's basically, we wanted to have a platform that everybody can enjoy, learn at the same time, and also know about our diversity. There are so many other festivals that happens around in Milwaukee, and we realized the market, and we realized that there was nothing specifically focused on Indian culture. So that's where the vision came to.
And I've actually wondered that before, given all the festivals that we have here, there's not an India festival. So what took so long? Anyone want to answer that one?
Well, I can get started with that. And I'm sure several other people before me, Shubhendu and Rina, have thought about it. And I can't answer as to why it was not done. I could only answer as to we thought about it. We're very dedicated enough to just pick the ball up and rolling. And the team that I have, I'm very, very proud of it because we have shown the Milwaukee market that it's not about having an idea, but it's all about having the courage to take the ball up. And there is a lot of resistance. There's a lot of new things that we're learning in the process, but we can all get better at the same time. And at the same time, we can bring something new to this area that we never had. So that actually one of the main reason for us to even become a little bit more enthusiastic about it. Hey, nobody have done it, so let's do a good job to the folks and bring them up and work with them to scale up.
Can you tell us then what is going to be there? How much of this is devoted to cultural, either information about India for people that aren't familiar or other cultural items versus food versus music, you know, all the stuff that you usually have at festivals?
We are keeping all the states of India to represent some of the other stuff of their culture. If you know about India, that each state is different language, different culture, different food, different way of living life. So totally different. If you cross one state to another state, you feel that you came to a different country. So as the Purnima said earlier, that there's so much diversity is there. So we try to bring everything there by in dance, in song, in music. And there is one more factor in Indian culture is like here, the football in India is a cricket. So cricket is an integral part of the Indians. So we cannot forget the cricket wherever we are in this world. So in this festival, so one thing we added is that at last we have a cricket match. So from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., we have a 2-hour cricket match will be there.
Purnima?
To add Shubhendu's point, I'd like to request all the listeners right now to jump up and join the cricket match as when you come.
Well, will there be any kind of tutorial for those who have never played or want to?
We'll definitely explain what cricket is. We'll also take volunteers as we go along. But we would have people assigned to play and show how it is played. We have a solid 2 hours to demonstrate and bring the energy up and see how this game is played. It's very close, very similar to baseball, but that does have some differences in it. And you will see how actually cricket unites people too from different states.
Let's talk about some of the individual events that are going to be there on that day. Go ahead.
Yeah, the first thing is we are going to do a parade for the kids. The concept is like the kids who are belonging from which state, they will represent the state dress wise, and in that way we can show the dress up. I mean, it's very, our dress is very colorful, so each kid will represent each state. And then the other thing is we are going to have a fashion show, which will have the kids and then the family and then men and women section also. There also we are showing our dress, our colorfulness of our dressing sense and all stuff. And then Purnima can continue with the other and Shubhendu also with the program section.
So the parade is more children-oriented?
Yes, and for children, so that they will holding a Indian flag, and we are telling all the kids to draw their own flag, and so that they will enjoy doing that, and they will bring that and dress up like that, and that's our starting of our program that day.
And then the fashion show is for everyone
in between. Yeah, okay. Fashion show is for everybody.
Okay, Purnima.
Sure. You know, the way we are bringing this to the people of Milwaukee is we want to represent as many estates as possible and the different flavor as possible. So let's say, you know, Bhangra is a pretty popular folk dance of Punjab. And then you have Bharatanatyam, which is pretty popular classical dance form from South India. I think it was originated in Tamil Nadu, but it's also encompasses in Karnataka and Kerala and other states as well. There are other dance forms like Odissi is from Odisha. There is Mohiniyattam that's from Kerala. There is Dandiya from Gujarat. So we are showcasing several different art forms from a state perspective to have a cohesive platform. And also the other thing beyond any states is Bollywood, as you know, right? It's all over India. It's very popular Indian Hindi cinema that we are all aware of. We're doing several music and dance for that as well. So it's very energetic, very fun, very hip. So that's something that we're all bringing together.
So we'll be able to see each one of these dance styles and origins there.
Yes. And okay, we're also going to give some information about where they are coming from, what it means, because the fact is that it's not only just for Indians, but it is for all. So we want to be as inclusive as possible to spread awareness of our culture, colorfulness, diversity.
Shubhendu, do you have something to add?
Purnima used some of the words like Punjab, Tamil Nadu, MP. So these are the states from India. So those who doesn't know, for them.
Okay, Purnima, we were talking in the lobby before we came in here, and I was trying to get a grasp of who formed what happened first, and it was ended up being a little reverse of your typical order. The festival was formed first, and then Spindle is the organization that is now sponsoring the festival.
Correct. Yeah. Interestingly, it's a great question, Dan. I think there is a message in it. The way I want to phrase it is we actually came up with a service and a product first. Then we went in to create an organization behind it. We were, from the beginning itself, we were very focused on quality. And we were also focused on something that has the local community has not never seen it. It's not that to the point that, hey, nobody have seen Bhangra or nobody have seen Bharatanatyam or any other programs that happens in other organizations. What happens is, each of the states are very focused on doing their own thing. They do it very well as well. But what I personally have seen is that we don't have a platform to have a cohesiveness. So that's where I think our goal was, hey, so many festivals that happens as a French fest or German fest or Irish fest, why not India Fest? And at that time, we didn't, go through, figure out who has thought about it, what the thought process was. We just said, let's do it. So we then figured and formulated our service. Then we figured out how do we deliver it? What is the platform do we deliver it through? That's where Spindle India came into picture. And we had so many different great ideas that we wanted to take it to the next level. So that's why you heard me saying we have done it other way around. We created the product and services first, then we created the organization around it to make sure that, hey, it is a long-term vision and we do want to scale up to a larger level.
Is Spindle India's main function the festival, or are there other programs you hope to develop out of it?
We are an organization that's very focused on community. We're not going to be another Indian organization, but we're going to be an organization that actually helps the community. At this point, we are helping Indian culture to come out to Milwaukee. We're going to do several other things that is more towards helping kids, helping education, health-wise. So we're going to do so many different things that my head just spinning with so many different ideas, and Shubhendu had a lot of ideas as well. So in short, it is not going to be another Indian organization. We don't want to be known as an Indian organization. We want to be known as a community-specific organization that actually helps the community.
So the second thing is that what Purnima said, I'm just going to the program section again. As Purnima said, that there are other Indian organizations out there who does everything very good. But we want to club all of them together. We're starting with the flag hoisting parade to the ending with the cricket. So this is the range, and we are using the Bollywood dances and Bollywood songs also. So we covered from the flag hoisting to the cricket patch. So that is the range we have right now. And in next couple of months or the next year, we have more programs, which is we are thinking we'll do it. It is for the full community, not specific to any section.
Well, thank you, all three of you, for coming in. I look forward to going to the festival.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please spread the word and bring your family and friends.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ren.
Pramina Nath is the president of Spindle India, which is organizing India Fest Milwaukee. Shubindu Modak is secretary of the group, and Rena Modak is the treasurer. India Fest Milwaukee runs all day Saturday at Humboldt Park in Bayview. You can find out more from a link at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. You don't have to go to India Fest to love Indian food, but it can be tricky if you can't handle gluten. A local author gets us around the gluten conundrum when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. Before the break, we got a preview of India Fest Milwaukee, the city's latest addition to a broad lineup of ethnic festivals. For an increasing number of people in this country, Indian food plays a key role in their diet. But at the same time, the number of people in this country who avoid gluten in their diet is growing as well. It's an issue on the radar of Milwaukee chef and author Alamelu Vaivaran. She's written several cookbooks and is host of the local PBS production Healthful Indian Flavors with Alamelu. She's an advocate of healthful eating and of Indian cuisine. Her latest book, co-authored with dietitian Margaret Pfeiffer, is Indian-Inspired Gluten-Free Cooking. Vaivaran tells Lake Effect's Dan Harmon why she chose to combine Indian influences with gluten-free offerings.
I was doing quite a lot of presentations in the public, in the university outreach program, hospital outreach programs, libraries, farmers market, and whenever I finish cooking the vegetables or rice dishes, people will often come to me and say, Alamelu, is this gluten-free? Is this gluten-free? And there was an enormous interest on gluten-free, and being a healthcare professional myself, I worked with a lot of registered dietitians. So I went and talked to them and they said, yes, the Indian food naturally lends itself to gluten-free, especially South Indian cooking. We don't use wheat that much. Wheat is a staple food in Northern India. Rice is a staple food in Southern India. And another unique thing about South Indian cooking is we use variety of vegetables in everyday meal. And so they said, Alamelu, the vegetable, rice dish, and the lean proteins will lend itself to gluten-free diet. So I decided that's what I want to do. I want to help all these people enjoy good, flavorful food. So let's work on it. That's what I did.
Okay. Well, just paging through the cookbook, it's not hard to notice that it isn't just Indian. I mean, as the title says, it's Indian-inspired.
Yes.
But there's a lot of items in there that you wouldn't typically think would lend themselves well to even Indian-inspired food, like we were talking before about Brussels sprouts.
Right.
And polenta.
Yes. Brussels sprouts, as I, you know, when I was growing up in India, I have tasted Brussels sprouts, broccoli, and all of these things. Those are our unique vegetables that you get it only in the high-end market in India. And I was exposed to those kind of vegetables when I was growing up. So Brussels sprouts, broccoli were all not new to me. And I saw how they prepared the dishes instead of just steaming and boiling and putting some butter. The cooks in my parents' home, how deliciously they prepared these cruciferous vegetables, you know, like cabbage, Brussels sprouts, kale, cauliflower into a very aromatic, flavorful dish. So I was very familiar with those unusual vegetables. So I thought I will include them in this book. And of course, salmon, quinoa, polenta are all wholesome, healthy foods that we get here. We wanted to broaden the scope. So we thought it will be innovative to add Indian flavor to these good, healthy foods. So we decided to add some spice to make it more appealing and flavorful. That's why we called it Indian inspired.
Well, and that seems to be a complaint. I mean, I know people who are celiac and are gluten-free. And one complaint is, well, the commercially available products that you get off the shelves are just really bland and boring. So was that something you wanted to get across, is that you don't have to go there?
Exactly. I also, besides working on these cookbooks, you know, I was very fortunate to connect with the professor at MD Anderson Cancer Care Center in Houston, Texas. His name is Dr. Bharat Agarwal, and he has published a book called Healing Spices. And spices have intrinsic health benefits. And I want to inform and educate the public that we can reduce the salt and the fat by enhancing the food with spices, and it adds so much flavor to it, cutting down on salt and heavy cream and all those things. So, yes, spices have intrinsic health benefits. And when you cook all these salmon, quinoa, polenta, vegetables with spices and lentils, you can have anyone love the vegetables and make vegetable haters to vegetable lovers.
Although that's not necessarily the focus of the book, because there are fish.
Yeah,
and
there
meat
are
dishes,
fish,
right?
Of course. I do have lean proteins like chicken, fish, shrimp, ground turkey. And lamb is very commonly cooked in non-vegetarian home in India. So I decided to add the lambs too.
Well, were there any difficult moments or difficult or surprises as to trying to make something gluten-free? I mean, are there items that you just were at your wit's end trying to find out how you make something gluten-free?
I know. I have published 4 cookbooks before this. And on all those cookbooks, I have taken the ready-made spice mixes that's available in the Indian grocery store, and I have prepared all the dishes, like sambar powder, it's called rasam powder, chutney powder. Those are all mixes of specific spices that is roasted and ground and packaged, and it's readily available. That's what I was using. But when I started working on the gluten-free cookbook, my co-author, Margaret Pfeiffer, who's a registered dietitian, she went through those packages very carefully, and she said, Alamelu, we can't use any of these products because it has some wheat in it. And she looked at it and she said, these are all we can't use. So I said, okay, I'm going to think about how I can make authentic dishes with locally available ingredients. So I went to the mainstream grocery store, Dan, and just bought the cayenne, ground cumin. And of course, now the main grocery stores have a big spice aisle. So it's no difficulty finding those. But I brought them home. And instead of using those ground mix that was available from India, I started using these spices, making the authentic dishes. I was kind of nervous to see how it's going to turn out, but believe it or not, it was very good. My husband said, this is really neat. You can get it from the locally available ingredients and make authentic dishes. So that was a challenge for me, to let go of those spice powders that I used to and then go experiment myself with new spices and try to make the authentic dishes. Otherwise, it wasn't that difficult. And having Margaret with me was wonderful, putting this cookbook together.
Well, I know India, Indian cuisine, of course, which is a huge world, is a mix of a lot of different influences from various points in history, just like American food is the same way. Yeah. Have you run afoul of any purists who say, well, this is really not Indian. This is
not really too hybrid. The books that I previously published focused mainly on South Indian cuisine. So I'm knowledgeable about what the dishes should look like and what it was like. And so I prepared those dishes, and I had never had anybody say, even if you go look on the book reviews on major internet, Amazon or whatever, they say, this is truly stick to the authentic flavors. I did not have any trouble about that, but right now this book is out, and I know some people have already used and have sent me emails saying it's very easy. There are only very few steps in each recipe, and I don't even have to make a trip to the Indian grocery store. One can, because it's interesting to go to the Indian grocery stores to explore all kinds of spices. But in America, everyone is so busy. They want something quick and easy to prepare. And so that's what we did. Get the locally available ingredients from the local grocery stores and try to put the dishes together.
And I know people who attempt Indian cuisine at home. Seems like the biggest fear I hear people mention is spices. They're afraid of the spices.
Right.
This one looks pretty straightforward.
Right. Yeah. And that's what I'm educating the Americans on, you know, in my television and in my presentation. I say spices have intrinsic health benefits. They aid in digestion. There is so many, like turmeric. Okay, turmeric is antioxidant, anti-cancerous, and the research studies shows that the use of turmeric on a daily basis also reduces the risk of Alzheimer's disease. And so in my presentation, it's not just cooking. I do a very good lecture presentation on spices and orient the public about the individual spices and their health benefits. And then I do the cooking program. And spices are not hot by themselves. The hotness really comes from green chilies and peppers. So if you reduce the green chilies and red peppers, the spices are really enhancement. They really enhances the flavor of the dish instead of bland and boring. You cook with the spices and you will see the kids coming running to the kitchen saying, what are you cooking? Can I taste this? And I have experienced this so many times in schools.
Do you have a couple of recipes you thought were the most fun?
I remember going to the middle school in Whitefish Bay and also Jewish Day School. They asked me to come for a cooking presentation, and I did vegetable rice pilaf. It has lima beans, green bell peppers, onions, tomatoes, and I have cashews and red onions, and decided to make this dish for the children when they tasted this dish and also another dish called green beans with lentils and coconut, otherwise known as Green Bay Packers Puriel because of the color.
Yeah,
green and
here,
yellow.
Yeah.
The kids, they were so interested in wanting to come and cut the vegetables with me, cook with me, and taste it. And when they are done tasting it, these are all 11-year-olds coming to me and asking me, Alamelu, where can we get your book? And when I have a birthday, can you come and do a cooking class for us at my home? And can you come and change the cafeteria food? So the kids were really excited. So I could cook this for anyone, including children. And I know for sure they would love it.
Well, Alamelu Vairavan, thank you for coming on Lake Effect.
Thank you very much, Dan. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Milwaukee chef Alamelu Vairavan is co-author of Indian-Inspired Gluten-Free Cooking, written with registered dietitian Margaret Pfeiffer. She's also host of the public television series Healthful Indian Flavors with Alamelu, and she talked with Dan Harmon. Lake Effect goes way out to the far reaches of the solar system and considers the moons of Pluto with our astronomy contributor when we return on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. Last month, our astronomy chat focused on the 13 moons of Neptune, the planet furthest from our sun. This month, we travel to the very edges of our solar system, to Pluto. Even though it is no longer considered a planet by many, Pluto still has moons. Astronomy contributor Gene Creighton tells Bonnie North the first one was discovered in 1978.
Charon was considered strange because Pluto is not that much bigger than this moon Charon, so that was a bit of a question mark. In fact, for most systems, the planet is so much bigger than the moon that the what we call the center of mass, where most of the mass lies, so which is the point that on either side you have 50-50% of the mass, is in the planet. That's the usual, but not in the case of Pluto and Charon, which of course was one of the many things that was strange about Pluto all along and one of the reasons why we realized that Pluto really should never have been a planet in the first place. But that doesn't mean we can't enjoy its lovely moons. And by the way, about Pluto itself, it was named by Venetia Burney, who was 11, this is in 1930, and she was from Oxford, England.
And Pluto was
the name that stuck. There were other names that were considered. I guess Minerva was a favorite, and Vulcan was another favorite, but it was considered that Pluto was the correct name, especially since PL were the initials of the person who discovered Pluto. So, setting that aside, subsequently, there have been two more moons called Nix and Hydra, and they were discovered fairly early on when the Hubble Space Telescope went up. Nix is from Nichta, which means night, and Hydra, of course, is the terrible monster that had the multiple heads. If you chopped one off, you got two for one. And Hydra, of course, was taken down by no other than Hercules. And that was the only labor that Hercules did for which he needed some help. He needed his nephew to assist him. Okay, so the other two, the more recent ones that were discovered in 2011 and 2012, have been fondly referred to as P4 and P5 for some time. The discoverer of these moons proposed a different scheme for naming them. Usually, and I'll read this because the name is so awkward, the committee that names astronomical objects is set from the International Astronomical Union is called Working Groups for Planetary System Nomenclature and Small Body Nomenclature.
Yeah, a very fancy way of saying the committee that names things.
That's right, the naming committee, yes. But anyway, I understand that's the name they use. So they ultimately have the final word. But the author thought it would be fun to choose 21 candidates. All the names that they put forward were connected to Greek myths and the underworld. And I'll tell you a story in just a second. But I just wanted to say that the list they chose, I fully support. I thought, oh, these are excellent names. Lethe, for example, is one of the rivers of the underworld, and it means oblivion. Lethe means oblivion in Greek. Acheronas was another one of the rivers. And some of you may know the names of Orpheus or Orpheus and Evridike.
That one I don't know.
You probably don't recognize it the way I say it. I confess I frankly don't remember how it's
Eurydice?
Yes. In Greek, Evridike. The other name that was included, which I thought was a bit of a stretch, was Vulcan, the god of metalworking, really. He was very crafty, and I mean that in a good sense. He was very good with his hands. That was the one, about 18,000 people put in votes. That was the one that came first. And although I think the discoverer wanted to make a case that Vulcan somehow is connected to Pluto, I believe most people chose Vulcan because Spock.
Of Star
came
Trek.
From
I was
going
to say,
yes.
It has to be a Star Trek thing. Yeah.
Yeah. But the committee saw through that and and I think correctly chose the two names that it did. Styx is the famous river that the gods swore by. And Kerberos, the three-headed dog that always protected the gates.
I was going to say guarded. Yeah,
yes.
There was a guarding.
Yes,
yep.
He was a guarding dog. And it allowed you to go in, but of course it didn't allow you to escape. or to leave. There are very few people who got to leave the underworld. Hercules is one, but of course the other one is Orpheus. And the story there, can I tell you a story?
Yes, yes, it's a great story too.
Okay, so here's the story. Orpheus and Eurydice were very, very much in love, and they were planning to get married and have children and live the good life. But sadly, they were by the river, and a snake bit Eurydice, and she died. He was absolutely heartbroken, Orpheus was, and he wanted so badly to join her that he was considering his options. Maybe he should go to the underworld and just be with her, or maybe he could cut a deal. He was a famous musician, and he thought that maybe if he brought his lyre with him, his harp, that he would be able to bring her back and try and convince Pluto, the god of the underworld, that
she belonged with
she
him.
Belongs, she yeah. really belongs with him. So he took his lyre and he sang down, went down to the underworld and managed to convince and sweet talk the ferryman to cross the river Styx that, yes, I can do that. It was Charon, by the way, to go and speak to Pluto himself. So he brought his lovely lyre and started singing songs of love. And Pluto, of course, had to have a very hard heart, because if he let every single person who had a loved one to leave, then he would be out of business pretty soon. So he wasn't going to yield. But his wife, Persephone, who was stuck living in the underworld pretty much against her will, she was touched by this story and said, surely we can leave one go. And sneaky Pluto said, I think we can, but there's one caveat. You will go first. She will follow you. You may not look back. You can only look back when you're out of my domain. If you look to make sure, if you have any doubt and you look back to see her, she will never be able to leave again. That's it. That's your one chance. So Orpheus thought, well, I can do that. And he was so pleased that he hears his chance. He's actually going to do what really can't be done normally. And Eurydice was thrilled that, of course, she would be reunited with her loved one, even though she was torn by doubt that how could this be? This might be a vision. This could be a cruel trick. So she started following Orpheus, and she needed some reassurances that this isn't a vision. And he would say, yes, just keep going. We're almost there. We're almost outside of this domain, and I'll be able to see you forevermore. But as you can imagine, of course, she was so upset, she was so worried that this is just a trick, that she did convince him to look. And that was the last time he saw her. So that might be the sad end of that story. And those names in the end didn't make the grade, as it were. But we do have great news, and that is that New Horizons, a spacecraft, is going toward Pluto, and we're hoping to see much more detail for all these objects around Pluto. So it is supposed to get there by July 14th, 2015. It is a great distance away from us, so it's more than halfway there. It left in 2006. It's going to travel within 8,000 miles of Pluto.
That's very close.
That's very close. Now, what's interesting to me is that four of these objects weren't discovered before New Horizons' path was designed. So the principal investigators, I'm sure, had sleepless night thinking, oh my God, what if our path hits one of these objects? That would be terrible. It turns out that it's not a concern. Charon is big enough that if there are small debris that happens because of these small moons hitting other small objects, that debris is probably going to be absorbed by Charon's gravitational field. So we're not too worried that there's going to be things that are moving too fast that might hit and destroy the spacecraft. There could be, but we're thinking that Charon has covered our back, thankfully. So we're going to stick with the original flight orbit. However, we're hoping that we can make some small adjustments, perhaps after we've gotten close to Pluto, to see other objects, either moons of Pluto or other Kuiper Belt objects, to understand more about those icy worlds that in some cases, bring us comets.
Oh, and we like comets.
We do. Remember? Cool, beautiful, crisp objects. Of which, we're going to see one, a fairly bright one, in November this year.
And which one is that?
It's called Pan-STAR, and it should be visible to us. Its best approach is going to be on Thanksgiving.
How perfect.
Fortuitous.
Yes.
So hopefully the weather will be good for us, so we will enjoy it again, and that's another little connection to Pluto.
Well, Jean, as always, I always learn so much when we sit and chat. Have a great rest of the summer, and we'll catch up with you in the fall.
Thank you.
Jean Creighton is the director of UW-Milwaukee's Manfred Olson Planetarium and is our regular astronomy contributor. She spoke with Bonnie North about the moons of Pluto. Tomorrow on the show, the debate continues over a proposed iron ore mine in northern Wisconsin. We'll hear from a leading opponent, plus some backers of the mine who spoke at a recent hearing. Plus, as filming wraps on an independent drama being shot in Milwaukee, we'll go to the set and chat with lead actor Sean Astin. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.